we need to govern our universities. And so I think that that's really where this came from. And that's where I hope we're going to go in the future, into the kind of strong mobilization to make ourselves a powerful force that can really stand up to the pressure from donors, the pressure from politicians, and put them back in their place. They do not have the right to make academic decisions. They are not entitled to redefine the mission of the university. They are not entitled to tear up the university's policies protecting the right to protest. We will not let them do it.
Welcome to AAUP Presents, a podcast by the American Association of University Professors. I'm the host, Mariah Quinn, AAUP's digital organizer. Today, we're talking about the upcoming National Day of Action for Higher Education on April 17th, when faculty across the country will be mobilizing to present a unifying message about the future of higher ed in light of the coordinated assault on higher education and academic freedom, including attempts to repress research and teaching, attacks on DEI, and structural attacks in the form of cuts to public funding and the rise of a contingent academic workforce. All things our listeners are familiar with as we've been examining these topics on the podcast over the past few years. The April 17th movement is led by faculty from AAUP chapters, other union locals, and members of the Higher Ed Labor United, HELU. They will be holding teach-ins, campus events, and press conferences to highlight the threats facing higher ed and reframe the solutions, creating a broad coalition to take action to fight for the common good along the way. In a statement of purpose about the Day of Action, organizers write, "Our struggles are linked, and so are our futures. On this National Day of Action and beyond, we commit to working together to build the universities and the democracy our society needs and deserves." Today, we'll talk to two of the organizers of the April 17th movement about how it came about and the path forward. My guests are Rebecca Carl, a professor of history at New York University and president of NYU AAUP, and Amy Offner, an associate professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and president of AAUP Penn. Let's get right into it. Can you give me a brief overview of what the Day of Action is meant to do, broadly speaking? And we'll get into the particulars shortly, but tell us what it is, why it matters, and why it's happening now. Amy, do you want to go first?
The National Day of Action is being organized by a coalition of higher ed labor organizations across the United States at both public and private institutions of all kinds to build solidarity and build power to create a more democratic and just system of higher education and a more democratic and just society. It was organized initially in response to a recognition that all of us are facing extraordinary threats to higher education, to our ability to research and teach, and to the ability of universities to serve any kind of a positive public purpose. So partly we're seeing attacks on a broad range of academic subjects, the ability to study and teach, for instance, African-American studies, the histories and cultures and politics of Israel and Palestine, attacks on research and teaching on gender and sexuality, on racism and imperialism. We're also seeing attacks on the right to assemble, to speak, to protest, and particularly we're seeing attempts to repress anti-war protest, protest against the war in Gaza, criticisms of the Israeli state and of Israeli government policies. So we've seen long-term disinvestment in public higher education, which has had the effect of contributing to the casualization of employment, which has really undermined the quality of education and the ability of scholars to do their work, of teachers to teach. It's also contributed to spiraling and unsustainable levels of student debt. We believe that higher education should be freely available to everybody who wants to get it. We think that there needs to be a reversal of decades of disinvestment and a new set of priorities that's going to put transformative levels of public investment into higher education to support education for the public good. So part of what we're trying to do is knit together mobilizations that are happening all across the country that are trying to both push back against these threats and then formulate a positive vision of well-funded higher education in the United States. higher education institutions that are internally democratic. And that means that labor organizing is necessary to that, unionization and the creation of labor organizations that give people an effective, powerful collective voice in the operation of their institutions. Institutions that support a wide range of research and teaching that can be spaces of academic freedom, that is to say, of critical, free, searching inquiry that can produce the kind of knowledge that's necessary for a democratic society. And we do think that ultimately this is about defending the democratic mission of higher education. These institutions need legitimate forms of democratic governance internally, which they presently do not have. And they also need to be part of the construction of a more legitimate form of democracy in the United States. I think the anti-democratic forms of governance that we're seeing at the state level and at the federal level go a long way to explaining, actually, the attacks on higher education that we're seeing, the attacks on racial justice measures that are necessary to the inclusive mission of higher education, attacks on fields of study that donors and politicians find inconvenient to their business interests and their political agendas. We need to really transform the systems of governance within the university and in the wider society in order to make higher education fulfill the purposes that it really ought to fulfill.
I would just add to that very comprehensive overview that one of the things that we're seriously trying to engage is how to imagine our campuses differently as spaces of education and politics and where students can self-educate about issues in the contemporary world, where education is not merely a classroom event, but also an event that happens on campuses more broadly. And so that to try to reverse the now really increasing regulatory regimes of our universities and our institutions that subject us to certain kinds of constraints, whether it's through the securitization of our spaces, whether it's through the restrictions on our right to assemble and our rights to engage in education and political activity as part of a community building that is not directed through and by the institution itself. I would just also add that the Day of Action is part of a grassroots bottom-up organizational strategy that came out of a particular set of events, the Gaza war or the genocide in Gaza, and the interrogation of university presidents in Congress that sort of galvanized a whole bunch of people at the local levels, at the grassroots, to really fight back at this point, to really understand how much under assault we actually are. So the defaming of faculty, the prosecution of students, mostly students of color, by our institutions and so on, all of these are issues that we are profoundly concerned with. And the Day of Action is intended to sort of highlight this in one big mode, but then to carry on through further organizing.
And why should faculty and others get involved, and how do they get involved?
The centerpiece of the Day of Action is locally organized actions on every campus that participates. So local unions, AUP chapters, student organizations working together to organize actions on their campuses focused on the issues that they're already organizing around. So on many campuses, this is going to be a series of actions, say, defending ethnic studies or defending racial justice measures on campus that are under attack from state legislatures or from donors. On other campuses, these are going to be actions in support of organizing drives and contract campaigns. We're right in the middle of a huge wave of union organizing all around the country. On other campuses, these are going to be actions that are focused on defending the right to speak and protest and engage in dissent, particularly around the war in Gaza. So there are all sorts of different actions that are being organized around the country, and participating means organizing an action on your campus. There's also going to be a live stream national teach-in that knits these issues together and talks about the kind of future that we want to create. What kind of a system of higher education do we want? And also, we hope we'll create conversations on campuses about where we go from here. As Rebecca mentioned, the purpose here is not just to have one day of action, which we hope will have an effect on, for instance, starting to change the really flawed and distorted media narrative of what's happening in higher education. But we hope that this is going to help to lay the groundwork for ongoing solidarity and mobilization across public and private institutions, across colleges, universities, community colleges, and also across different higher ed workers, students, communities that have really a shared interest in seeing more legitimate forms of democratic governance of our institutions and have an interest in seeing that higher ed is truly accessible to all and is a space of free inquiry, a space of critical inquiry, and a space where all of us are able to do our work and study under good conditions, you know, under conditions where people have job security, where they have a voice, and where they have, you know, freedom to engage in critical activity of all kinds. So we hope that this is going to be the beginning and not the end. And we see it as part of a series, actually, of mobilizations to that end that have taken place in recent years. HELU, Higher Ed Labor United, has been very involved in organizing the National Day of Action right from the start. And they've been working for several years to build the kind of infrastructure among, you know, rank and file higher ed labor organizers around the country. We see this as a contribution to that larger project.
Yeah, I would just emphasize what Amy has already said, that this is the Day of Action sort of punctuates a continuum of organizing that has already begun on some campuses already for a very long time in terms of unionization and so on other campuses in terms of AUP chapters and other types of organizing. So we're hoping to foster the conditions through which the various forms of organizing can come together, can find. We understand that there's not going to be one unified voice forever, but we want to find points of unity and points of coherence and of convergence where we can amplify our voices together in a way that allows the very different situations on different campuses to understand that we share a certain environment of attack on the autonomy of and the utility even and the value of a higher education. We've seen all of those things get seriously attacked in the past decades. And this is the moment at which we've decided that enough is enough. And we really do need to come together and to have a larger voice in shaping the national discourse. And, you know, many of us work in universities where we have global presences as well. And so that these are also not merely national issues. These are also global issues.
The organizers of the April 17th Day of Action have released a statement outlining what you stand for. Let's walk through that. It says you stand for democracy, given the extraordinary attacks on both democratic institutions and higher education. And we've talked a little bit about that. And this is also linked to the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn and the value of dissent, all of which are mentioned in the statement. Can you give us a little more context about why those were chosen as core issues for this statement and day?
Sure. We do think that universities are necessary to democracy, for one thing. In a democracy, people need to be able to make decisions about a huge range of things, issues, you know, far beyond what any one person could know on their own through their own research and reading and personal experience. And one of the functions of universities is to produce the kind of credible knowledge that can inform democracy. And that requires universities to be spaces of free and open inquiry. That's under attack right now in the United States, with state legislatures trying to roll back job security, which is necessary for people to be able to engage in free and open inquiry. The origins of the tenure system are in the attempt to defend faculty members from basically losing their jobs because businessmen on boards of trustees or members of state legislatures wanted them gone because they were doing research that was inconvenient to their political agendas and business interests. So we think that, you know, building up systems of labor organization, job security are necessary for universities to produce knowledge for the public good, which is necessary to a democracy. The other aspect of this is thinking about universities as institutions that need democratic governance internally. One of the things that we've seen, you know, certainly in the crisis of the last, you know, 6 months, is that one of the reasons that students and faculty have been so vulnerable to attacks on the right to conduct research and teaching or the right to speak and protest is because over time, our own voice within the institution has been weakened so tremendously. The power of donors, of unelected and unaccountable boards of trustees, the power of state legislatures that are frankly committed to the destruction of democracy in many states, that has an effect that has created a situation in which they're able to reach into universities and try and stifle speech, stifle protest, and stifle forms of research and teaching that they frankly don't believe in. And so we think that building up unions, labor organization, and other forms of collective democratic voice within our institutions and creating legitimate forms of democratic governance is itself necessary and it's part of the construction of a democratic society.
Yeah, I would add to that at some very quaint level, I suppose. I'll just go back to quaintness. The wash of misinformation in which we are engulfed these days requires a real critical ability to distinguish what is real and what isn't real. I mean, this is, you know, goes back to a really important set of skills that we do in education. We teach students how to adjudicate amongst different forms of information. And that seems to me, given how awash we are in various kinds of mis and disinformation campaigns, that this is, you know, a fundamental problem that we deal with and that we have a real commitment to a democratic future in which a voting public is indeed well-informed and equipped to figure out what that actually means. Aside from that, democracy requires a certain amount of self-organization. And the ways in which students can self-organize, the ways in which faculty can self-organize, the ways in which staff can self-organize, and the ways in which we self-organize together around areas of common concern is a process, a procedural issue that I think is important for us, for the ways in which we conduct our lives in education. The universities now are awash in industry and financialized money and other kinds of constrictions that then those of us who are deemed less useful to the reproduction and accumulation of wealth are more or less set aside or cast aside or are deemed less important. And yet since the inception of education in the United States, at least, or public education as a value in the United States, humanities, critical inquiry, liberal arts, and so on have been fundamental to that. Now we're seeing that being completely sidelined and undercut. And so a lot of this is about the ways in which higher education has been transformed in the image of money donors and political conservative, very limited views of political elites, and how our society is now being completely reconfigured around AI and dis and misinformation. So rather than see education as disposable right now, we see it as absolutely fundamental.
And the statement also talks about structural attacks in terms of lack of funding in the form of federal and state divestment, the rise of contingency, and the rise of student debt. These are things people in the movement have been talking about for decades. How does messaging about this as part of the broader narrative serve your goal of reframing and mobilizing even more action in these crucial areas?
I would just say that the recent several decades of living in an era of austerity for higher education when even in the years when the stock market was booming, even in the years when money was being accumulated, wealth was being accumulated at historical levels of rapidity, that these are social choices. The choice to subject public education and education in general to austerity is a choice. These are choices that we think we can reverse or we can address by mobilizing a far greater voice for the value of education as against the discourse of austerity and the realities of that have been imposed upon us of austerity. As I say, these are choices. We have to reverse these choices and force different kinds of choices.
And we've also seen how labor organization is an instrument to push back against austerity and against the harm that it does to education and to everyone within the university. So, for instance, we've seen really strong protections for academic freedom for both tenure track and non-tenure track faculty members. Academic freedom has to, you know, be secure for everyone who's engaged in the work of research, teaching, and learning. And union organizing and contracts have been some of the most important instruments for trying to secure that. It's important to understand that the attacks on the funding of higher education, on job security, the, you know, conversion of jobs into you know, casual, you know, adjunct positions, that has an effect on people's ability to do the work that, you know, universities are supposed to do. It means that people have, first of all, less time to put into the research and teaching that that they're trained and prepared to do. It also means that people are less likely to be free to teach their subjects in an honest way when they're teaching about subjects that are, you know, that might arouse the ire of wealthy donors or of members of state legislatures or of administrators who don't have the academic qualifications and frankly don't have the right to make curricular decisions, but who may hold the power of termination over a faculty member. And so pushing back against austerity, pushing back against casualization is necessary to ensure that universities are actually able to provide courses that are designed by educators rather than by CEOs and politicians. It's necessary to make sure that students have the freedom to learn, the freedom to study, the freedom to be exposed to a full range of subjects taught by people who are trained as scholars and educators. It's necessary to the educational mission of the university. And it's also something that affects every person in the university. We've been talking a lot about faculty members, and faculty, I think, are often depicted as overprivileged elites with a whole bunch of esoteric needs and interests. But as a matter of fact, the majority of faculty in the United States are employed in non-tenure track positions. They're severely underpaid. They do not enjoy job security. They have employment experiences very much like most people in the United States. And we're also thinking, though, about every person who works at the university. We've seen attacks on, you know, every category of worker who, you know, makes universities run: dining hall workers, janitors, librarians, people who work in university museums. All of them have faced similar forms of restructuring, similar threats to their ability to do their jobs and to have a dignified work experience. So we think universities need both adequate funding, and they need legitimate forms of democratic governance and voice internally that will make them, you know, decent places to work, decent places to learn and study, and the kinds of institutions that we would be proud to have in our society.
I would just add that, you know, it is now over 70% of the instructional faculty at universities now are casual labor, are non-tenure track, are some on short-term contracts and some on longer-term contracts. This just is a huge reversal that has taken place sort of under the radar in many places over the past 20 years or so. And the efforts to get rid of tenure, to put further constrictions on tenure and so on, is all part of this effort to make universities more like nimble corporate concerns, as it were, even though there are vast differences between the ways in which universities operate and corporations do. But nevertheless, it's the whole effort to casualize labor, not only amongst the faculty, but amongst kitchen staff, amongst librarians, amongst everybody who used to be able to make an actual living at universities now is living in a state of precarity. And not everybody, but many people. And that's just unacceptable. Those are conditions of learning that are quite difficult for students. And students themselves are coming to understand this. One of the things about this day of action is because students often go through their university careers slightly oblivious to the way in which universities actually operate. And so one of the things we're really hoping to do is to also alert students and to bring students into this effort to help change and transform the conditions of their own learning. Because I've found very much in my classrooms that the students have no idea what the difference between a full-time tenured professor is and a contract professor. They have no clue. And so when I tell them what the differences are, they're quite dismayed.
So this is a grassroots effort, as you've alluded to, with the organizers coming from a variety of unions and higher ed related organizations. It's kind of always interesting to hear how movement builds, especially in a time when we're seeing a lot of that, from UAW to Hot Labor Summer to Starbucks to teachers. So how did the conversations come about, and how did you move from talk to organizing and mobilization in this case?
This really got started in the fall when a lot of AAUP chapters around the country started getting in touch with each other. Rebecca and I got in touch with each other and others who've been involved in this. And all of us were facing incredible repression on our campuses. Faculty and students and staff who were engaged in anti-war protest were being defamed and threatened. Teaching and research on Israel and Palestine was being squelched really across the country. And so it was in the context of that particular crisis that we started talking to each other. There was a lot more background to that, as Rebecca has noted, where this came also in the wake of actually a really positive wave of union organizing that had already been knitting together bonds of solidarity and connections between campuses. And so we started to talk about the fact that we really needed to be mobilizing, not just on our own campuses, but we needed to be mobilizing together, both to push back against the threats that we were facing and to build the kind of infrastructure of rank and file mobilization across the country to build a system of higher education that we needed. And so one of the things we've been doing is, we've been just reaching out, not just within AAUP to other AAUP chapters to get as many involved as we can, but one of the most important things we've been working to do is to involve all kinds of higher ed organizations. So reaching out to, all unions that represent workers in higher education, reaching out to student debt organizers. So trying to make this the most broad-based mobilization that we can, and to think about the kind of what one colleague calls the web of predation that all of us are entangled in, but also the positive vision of what a university should be for that we want to work for together. So it's been a process of actually building the kinds of networks of communication and relationships that haven't always existed actually among campus workers, students, and labor organizations that, cross many of these divisions and across the country.
Yeah, I would just add to that, highlight, of course, Amy's extraordinary role in hailing us into being. She has done a Herculean amount of work to organize us and keep on message and on track. In addition to the repressions that Amy mentions that were some of the precipitating issues, were also the problems of self-organized educational endeavors like teach-ins being surveilled and shut down, where students who were desperate to educate themselves about the issues of the contemporary world, Gaza, for example, on my campus, also Xinjiang and China issues and so on. But because we have a global university and because we have a branch in Shanghai, we are often told that we cannot say these things, we cannot do these things. And so the assaults on students' self-organized attempts to educate themselves about the contemporary world in ways that reach them, in ways that appeal to them. And so on. All of this has been sort of subjected now to oversight, institutional surveillance, and so on. I mean, and so a lot of these issues then are about a grassroots effort that, you know, often enough, our students are like 10 steps ahead of us on this stuff. And so we're just trying to run to catch up to them. And so to come out of our grassroots organizing and to come out of the chapters themselves and to think about the ways in which a bottom-up organizing strategy without any kind of one voice unified message, but with a series of points of convergence, that's part of what we're attempting to do. And so the statement, to go back for a moment, for what we stand for, is written in a way that is both as capacious as possible and as specific as possible in order to cover the range of differences on the different campuses that we actually do confront.
So these are nationwide problems that we've been talking about, but let's dive into the particulars. What has been happening on your own campuses or in your states that brought you to this work?
What's been happening at the University of Pennsylvania has been so profoundly misrepresented in the national press for months now that actually it is important to discuss. On the one hand, when we came into this year, this was a union organizing year at Penn, just like it is at a lot of universities around the country. There's been a massive and really incredible wave of union organizing on our campus. In the last couple of years, workers at the Penn Museum organized, residential advisors organized. There was a successful organizing drive among the house staff, the residents, the doctors at Penn Medicine. And right now there's a massive organizing drive taking place among research and teaching assistants that is very inspiring. So there's been a huge wave of organizing drives, contract campaigns, and there's also mobilization happening among other workers who are mobilizing around specific issues and may lead to organizing drives down the road. There's also this year, there's been an immense and very powerful effort by donors to attack the university. And it's important to understand that what they're trying to attack are faculty and students, the core educational mission of the university, and really the ability to engage in research and teaching. And so this is an effort that has it preceded the start of the war in Gaza, actually. It originally was a straight-up attack on academic freedom in which donors tried to shut down a literature festival devoted to Palestinian literature. And they whipped up false and inflammatory claims that supposedly a legitimate academic event was supposedly a platform for anti-Semitic messages. Journalists who attended that event did not find anti-Semitic messages being articulated there. This was part of a wider effort that these donors had been engaged in for years to roll back the gains of the civil rights movement. They're trying to attack racial justice measures at the university. They're trying to attack fields of study that they simply disagree with for political reasons or that they find to be threatening to their business interests. And they then capitalized in a really dangerous way on the war in Gaza to go after really all research and teaching on Israel and Palestine, all forms of anti-war protest. They have had a very chilling effect, actually. It's remarkable to see that, you know, at a time when the university should be having conferences, lectures, teach-ins, you know, events that would help people comprehend what's going on in the Middle East, the silence on campus from academic centers has been deafening because they have been threatened by donors. They have been threatened by members of Congress. Faculty and students have experienced a really chilling wave of targeted harassment whipped up by far-right media that has worked in tandem with pressure from donors, pressure from Congress. It's very important for people to understand that the targets of this are not the university presence. The targets of this are faculty, students, and staff. And the targets of this are the educational mission of the university to be able to engage in research and teaching, to be able to study comprehend and engage in dissent around problems in our world. Dissent is part of education. Dissent is part of democracy. We've been mobilizing in response to that. Our chapter has doubled in size this year, precisely because there are a lot of faculty members, tenure track, non-tenure track, people across the university, every school, not just the School of Arts and Sciences, although lots of people in the School of Arts and Sciences, but the medical school, the Wharton School, engineering, the vet school, all of whom recognize that all of us are under attack. The very mission of the university is under attack. And so we've been mobilizing in defense of academic freedom, and we've been starting to think really about the illegitimate system of governance that has made us so vulnerable to these attacks and that has made, you know, the educational mission so vulnerable. I think that all of us have a lot to learn in that sense from the organizing drives that were the agenda when we started this year. I think that a lot of us have seen that university administrators are themselves subject to immense pressure that they have been unable to withstand and they've been unable to push back against. None of us can depend on being protected by somebody else. What all of us need is an organized, powerful, collective voice and the ability to make decisions in our universities. We need to govern our universities. And so I think that that's really where this came from. And that's where I hope we're going to go into the in the future, into the kind of strong mobilization to make ourselves a powerful force that can really stand up to the pressure from donors, the pressure from politicians, and put them back in their place. They do not have the right to make academic decisions. They are not entitled to redefine the mission of the university. They are not entitled to tear up the university's policies protecting the right to protest. We will not let them do it.
Some fighting words with which I agree completely. The situation at NYU is different in particulars, but often very similar in the larger sense. We too have seen large waves of successful unionization, totally at each step contested by the university and fought by the university in the most vile ways possible, with the most vile anti-union busting sort of law firms involved, same ones always. In face of that kind of institutional assault, there's been an impressive amount of solidarity, not only within unions but between unions as well. The other thing I would add to what Amy said is that it is in part exactly the success of universities in diversifying that has caught administrators by surprise, that this in fact involves not merely tokenism, but in fact the transformation in fields of study. They hadn't understood that by adding what they thought were token diversity bodies was actually going to change how the university, how fields of study work. I mean, that was the whole point. And donors, administrators, and so on haven't donors understood this and have tried to roll this back because they understand that tokenism doesn't work in the university quite the way it does in the corporate world. And I would applaud our universities often enough for their success in diversifying, and yet the having missed the point of what that was all about. And so we have to protect that initiative. We have to protect that and push it far, far more clearly into a more transformative sense, not only of governance, but of how we engage in our fields of study, how we engage in our academic work. I mean, so much of the academic work that is new and exciting actually does link up to the real world, as it were. And yet that is the threat that people, I mean, that donors and trustees and administrators find incredibly difficult if it's not feeding into industry and it's not patented and it's not able to, you know, accrue wealth. And so I think that from my perspective, at least, it's been the real success of these efforts that has caught administrators and donors and trustees off guard and that has contributed to the virulence of the backlash attacks in many ways. Obviously, this has been ongoing for a very long time. I mean, since before diversity, before DEI was even invented as an acronym. But it's the virulence, I think, of recent years and of the contemporary moment is really due to a certain form of success, in at least in certain places and in certain fields.
You are both professors of history. Can you place this multitude of attacks facing higher ed in context for us? Is this an extraordinary moment and thus an extraordinary response, or is it something we've seen before?
I think that what we're looking at right now in terms of the threats is part of a decades-long effort to roll back the gains of the Black Freedom Movement and the social movements of the 1960s and 1970s. And to think about what those did, I think we need to kind of think about the McCarthy period, actually. The anti-communist hysteria of the late 1940s and 1950s had the effect of, first of all, within our universities, purging faculty members who, for the reason that they were involved in the civil rights movement, in the labor movement, it impoverished the intellectual life of our entire society by ridding our universities of important scholars in many fields. The sciences suffered, the social sciences suffered, the humanities suffered. And in many ways, it was the social movements of the 1960s that helped to revive our universities. They opened them up again to, and in many cases for the first time actually, to people, to entire fields of knowledge and areas of study that had been closed out, that had been shut out. And not just within the university, but of course in the wider society, attempts to reverse those gains, they date back to the very moment of their consolidation. They include the very kinds of arguments that we're seeing today. So for instance, at Penn, it's been absolutely tragic to see donors try to argue that diversity at Penn, that basically the fact that Black students and faculty now have a toehold in the university, they present that as something that has harmed Jews at the university. And I am Jewish, and I really take offense to this argument. It's an argument that goes way back, actually. It's an argument that segregationists used in the 1960s to argue against the civil rights legislation of that period. They argued that widening opportunities for African Americans was going to harm Jews. That's an argument that conservatives really took up, particularly in the 1970s. So when we look at the kinds of arguments that are being made today, for instance, arguments to roll back DEI measures or more broadly racial justice measures at universities, they are the direct legacy of reaction against the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. And they really are the resurrection of that earlier McCarthyist impulse to close down areas of study, to narrow the accessibility of higher education, and to make a society in which many questions can't be asked, in which many movements are deemed to be, egalitarian movements are deemed to be illegitimate threats to the nation. So I do think that, there are historical origins to this. There are historical resonances to this. One thing that makes this moment a little different is the wave of union organizing that is concurrent with it. The labor movement was felled in a lot of ways. It was really constrained by the repression of the early Cold War. And right now, we're not seeing that yet. We're actually seeing incredible labor mobilization across the U.S. economy. And I think that that gives me hope that we have a different kind of capacity for power right now that can allow us to beat back what we're facing.
I would say, in addition to that, I work in a field, China studies, that was decimated in the 1950s with the Who Lost China McCarthyite assaults. And it took many decades for China studies to rebuild from that. And that was, of course, in the era of the Cold War. My career happens to have spanned the moment when we have moved from China, we moved into China fever. China was everything, and now it back into a China panic, which is, China is everything in a bad way. And the ways in which those of us who study China are being accused of possible traitorous or behavior has turned the university, along with all of the other ways in which the university has become subjected to certain forms of constraints, has turned the university for a lot of us into a really treacherous site because it's become quite difficult. I too am Jewish, and because I am pro-Palestinian, I've been subjected to all forms of hate speech and so on that have been targeted towards me. But we have to see this as part of an ongoing wave. Back in the 19-teens, back in the Red Scares, of the early Red Scares, then through the 50s and so on, but higher education has consistently been under attack. I think, as Amy says, what makes this time different is the labor organizing, but also there's been a broad public consensus that higher education is valuable. And I think that consensus has now gone away. I think that consensus is now very much under attack. I think that because of money, financialization, conservatism, you know, various forms of transformations, that consensus no longer exists, or no longer exists as robustly as it had before. And so I think that part of what we need to do is to rebuild that consensus and to rebuild it around a university that is self-governed, that is autonomous from the political fights of the in legislatures and so on. Not autonomous insofar as in the sense that it's disconnected from politics. In fact, universities have to be political spaces in order to be relevant spaces, but they have to be political spaces that are not surveilled, politicized, and so on by others. They have to be parts of the world in the ways in which we educate ourselves and we educate our students and our staff.
We've talked about the reasons behind the Day of Action, the issues facing higher ed, and why the movement's happening now. So looking forward, what do you hope the outcome of the April 17th Day of Action will be?
We have follow-up meetings scheduled in April and May to discuss exactly that, because I think the goal here is to get this this coalition that participates in the Day of Action to be an ongoing network, to continue building, and to think very concretely about what the legislative program might be at the state level, at the federal level, to think about what our shared organizing goals are in terms of union organizing and other forms of labor organizing, to think about a common positive program that, you know, derives from the, you know, the basic, you know, principles that are in the statement that we discussed. But I think that, you know, what you've indicated, that is the question. How are we going to channel the energy of this day into a program? And I think the only way to do that is through participation. So we really hope that people will attend those meetings, which are going to be at the end of April and the beginning of May, to put that together and to, you know, get involved. To we're going to need an ongoing structure of, you know, committees to do this work, to plan for the fall, to plan for next spring, to think about, you know, what forms of action, what kind of power are we going to, you know, be building to win a program that's going to have to be very concrete?
Part of what we're hoping for is also a very robust bottom-up grassroots coalition that will have to be maintained after, and we're committed to trying to maintain it, of course, after April 17th. We're all doing this in addition to to the actual work that we're being paid to do, which is, you know, to teach and work in our institutions. And so we're going to have to start spreading the work around a little bit more, because those of us, particularly Amy and a couple others who have been, you know, super, super involved and mobilized, are, you know, we have to recognize this is going to be a relay. This can't be a marathon. I mean, one person can't be running this whole thing. I mean, we have to pass batons. And we're going to have to figure out how that works. But I think we're all committed to trying to make that work. We have a pretty good network now of, you know, 20, 25, 30 activist chapters. And we're hoping that those expand fundamentally to larger numbers. We've been in conversation with now, I think it's been 100 or more, right, chapters. And so I think we're in a good position to make this a durable movement that will be punctuated by events, but that has a continuing presence beyond the events.
Thanks to both Amy and Rebecca for joining me on the podcast today. You can find links to the call to action and a form to RSVP to participate in the April 17th movement in the show notes. We have a new episode coming out soon on EdTech and the technological forces shaping and often harming higher education. It's a really interesting topic, so make sure you tune in. Subscribe to AAUP Presents on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform to get notified when new episodes are released. Thanks for listening. I'm Mariah Quinn for AAUP Presents.